the prince of this world. Sin, made flesh, whose character is revealed in the works of the flesh, is the wicked one of the world. He is styled by Jesus the prince of this world. Cosmos, rendered world in this phrase, signifies that order of things constituted upon the basis of sin in the flesh and styled the kingdom of Satan as opposed to the kingdom of God, which is to be established upon the foundation of the Word made flesh, obedient unto death. Incarnated sin and incarnated obedience are the basis of the two hostile kingdoms, of God and of the adversary. The world is Satan's kingdom. Therefore it is that the saints, or people of God, both Israelites outwardly and Israelites indeed, are a dispersed and persecuted community. Satan's kingdom is the kingdom of sin. It is a kingdom in which sin reigns in the mortal body, and thus has dominion over men. It is quite fabulous to locate it in the region of ghosts and hobgoblins, remote from or under the earth, where Pluto reigns as god of hell. This notion is a part of the wisdom of those fleshly thinkers who, as the apostle says, professing themselves to be wise, became fools. A wisdom to which God hath made foolishness by the light of the glorious gospel of Christ. The kingdom of sin is among the living upon the earth, and it is called the kingdom of Satan because all the power of the enemy, or adversary, of God and his people is concentrated and incarnated in it. It is a kingdom teeming with religion, or rather, forms of superstition, all of which have sprung from the thinking of sinful flesh. This is the reason why men hate, or neglect, or disparage the Bible. If the leaders of the people were to speak honestly, they would confess that they do not understand it. Their systems of divinity are the untoward thinkings of sinful flesh, and they know that they cannot interpret the Bible intelligibly according to their principles. In all events, they have not yet accomplished it. Hence, one class have forbidden their people the use of the Scriptures at all, and have placed it among prohibited books. Another class advocates them, not because it walks by the light of them, but because they hate the tyranny of Rome. These, in their public exhibitions, substitute their sermonizings for reasonings out of the Scripture, and expounding out of the law of Moses and the prophets. Thus they neglect the Bible, or use it only as a book of maxims and mottos for their sermons, which, for the most part, have as much to do with the subject treated of in the text as with the science of gymnastics or perpetual motion. But the carnal policy does not end here. The neglect of the preachers might be supplied by the searching of the Scriptures by the people themselves, but this is discouraged by disparagements from the pulpit. The word is proclaimed to be a dead letter. The prophecies are said to be unintelligible, the apocalypse incomprehensible and utterly bewildering. That it is necessary to go to college to study divinity before it can be judiciously explained, and so forth. The people for whom I write know this to be the truth. But what is the English of all this? It is that the pulpit orators and newspaper scribes are consciously ignorant of the sure word of prophecy, so that in order to maintain their ascendancy, they must repress the enterprise of the people, lest they should become wiser than their teachers, and find that they could do infinitely better without their services than with them, and thus their occupation would be gone. As for a college education in divinity, qualifying boys for preaching the word, the absurdity of the conceit is manifest in the fact that the college-bred divines are all at variance among themselves upon its meaning. Call a convention of priests and preachers of all religious sects and parties, and assign to them the work of publishing a scriptural and unanimous reply to the simple question, "What do the Scriptures teach?" as the measure of faith and rule of conduct to him who would inherit the kingdom. Let it be such a reply as would stand the scrutiny of deep and earnest investigation, and what does the reader expect would be the result? Would their knowledge of all the languages living and dead, of Euclid's Elements, of Ligure, Bellarmine, Luther, Calvin and Arminius, of the mythologies of the Greeks and the Romans, of all the creeds, confessions, catechisms and articles of Christendom, of logic, ancient and modern, of the art of sermonizing, and of all religious controversies extant, would their acquaintance with such lore as this bring them to unanimity, and cause them to manifest themselves as workmen that need not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth? What can we reason upon this point but from what we know? Experience then teaches us that their performance of such a thing, so simple and easy in itself, would be utterly impracticable, for the thinking of the flesh is enmity against God, and until they throw away their traditions and study the word, which is a very different thing from studying divinity, they will continue as they are, perhaps unconsciously, the perverters and enemies of the truth. The kingdom of Satan is manifested under various phases. When the word was embodied in sinful flesh and dwelt among the Jews, the cosmos was constituted of the Roman world, which was then based upon the institutions of paganism. After these were suppressed, the kingdom of the adversary assumed the Constantinian form, which was subsequently changed in the West to the papal and Protestant order of things, and in the East to the Mohammedan. These phases, however, no more affect the nature of the kingdom than the changes of the moon alter her substance. The Lord that dominates over them all, from the days of Jesus to the present time, is sin, the incarnate accuser and adversary of the laws of God, and therefore styled the devil and Satan. The Greek word archon signifies the prince, or one invested with power. All persons in authority are styled archon in the New Testament, such as magistrates and the chiefs among the people. Hence the archon of the archons would be the chief magistrate of the kingdom. Now sin, in its sovereign manifestations among the nations, executes its will and pleasure through the civil and ecclesiastical authorities of a state. What then is decreed by emperors, kings, popes, and subordinate rulers are the mandates of the prince of the world, who works in them all to gratify their own lusts, oppress the people, and make war against the saints with all the energy they possess. Taken collectively, from the chief magistrate to the lowest, they are all styled principalities and powers, the world rulers of the darkness of this age, who are the spirituals of wickedness in the high places of the kingdoms. So the apostle writes of the rulers of the world in his day, and from the conduct they now exhibit before the nations in all their kingdoms, it is clear that the style is as characteristic of the rulers and of these times as it was in the first century of the Christian era. Iniquity has only changed its form and mode of attack against the truth. The world's rulers, temporal and spiritual, are as essentially hostile to the gospel of the kingdom as ever. They could not embrace it and retain the friendship of the world. This is as impossible now as at the beginning. But things are now quiet with respect to the gospel, not because the world is reconciled to it, but because there are scarcely any to be found who have intelligence of it, faith and courage enough earnestly to contend for it, as it was originally delivered to the saints. In apostolic times, it was the privilege of the church to make known to the world rulers the manifold wisdom of God. This mission brought the disciples of Christ into contact with them, as is related in the Acts. When they stood before these men of sin, in whom the thinking of sinful flesh worked strongly, the truth of God proclaimed to them brought out the evil of the flesh in all its malignity. They imprisoned the disciples of Christ, threatened them with death, tempted them with rewards, and when they could not shake their fidelity to the truth, tormented them with the cruelest tortures they could invent. The apostle styles these the artifices or wiles of the accuser, against which he exhorts believers to stand firm, being panoplied with the whole armour of God. The war being thus commenced by an attack upon the strongholds of power, the magistrates, urged on by the priests, were not content to take vengeance against them when they came their way. They obtained imperial decrees to hunt them out and to destroy them. This they did with destructive energy and effect. They calumniated the disciples, charged them with the most licentious and impious practices, and employed spies and informers who personated brethren to walk among them and watch an opportunity of accusing them before the judge. These adversaries of the Christians, being actuated by the same spirit of sinful flesh, the apostle terms your adversary the accuser, and to express the ferocious spirit that impelled the enemy, he compared him to a roaring lion walking about on the lookout for prey. Resist him, says he, not by wrestling with flesh and blood in personal combat, but by continuing steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are inflicted in the world upon your brethren. To walk, being dead in trespasses and sins, is to live according to the course of this world. So says the apostle. The course of the world is according to the thinking of sinful flesh, in whatever way it may be manifested or expressed. If a man embraced one of the religions of Satan's kingdom, he is still dead in trespasses and sins, and walks according to the course of the world. In brief, anything short of faith in the gospel of the kingdom and obedience to the law of faith is walking according to the course of the world. To walk in sin is to walk in this course. Hence the apostle terms walking according to the course of the world, walking according to the prince of the powers of the air, which he explains as the spirit now working in the children of disobedience. The power of the air, or aerial power, is the political power of the world, which is animated and pervaded by the spirit of disobedience, which is sin in the flesh, and styled above the prince of the power of the air. This is that prince of whom Jesus spoke, saying, "Now is the judgment of this world, now shall the prince of this world be cast out," that is, judged. The key to this is suggested in what follows. "And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me." This he said, signifying what death he should die. The judgment of the prince of the world by God was exhibited in the contest between Jesus and the civil and spiritual power of Judea. Its poison was like the poison of a serpent, when the iniquity of his heels compassed him about. The battle was against him for a time. They bruised him in the heel. The enemy smote his life down to the ground and made him to dwell in darkness as those that had been long dead. But here the serpent power of sin ended. It had stung him to death by the strength of the law, which cursed every one that was hanged upon a tree. Jesus, being cursed upon this ground, God condemned sin in the flesh through him. Thus was sin, the prince of the world, condemned, and the world with him, according to the existing course of it. But Jesus rose again, leading captivity captive, and so giving to the world an earnest that the time would come when death should be abolished and sin, the power of death, destroyed. Sinful flesh was laid upon him that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is, the devil, or sin in the flesh. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil.